Well, good evening, everyone. My name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and I want to extend a warm welcome for everyone who's joining us here for another Happy Hour with Dr. T. Each week, we get together with amazing guests and have conversations to inspire you and help you grow. You'll be able to find all the interviews in the podcast membership area when you become a podcast member by going to drtenpenny.com. So tonight is part three of another important series that we've put together on eschatology, the study of end times. Last year, you know, we had a whole series on Thursday nights with a very important pastors, Pastor Doug Woodward and Michael Lake and a whole bunch of different people. I won't go through the whole list. And all those are available under the education tab on drtenpenny.com. And all of the money, we sell those now that they've been through. And if you have missed them, you really should go back and re-listen to them. And any one of them that are purchased, all of the money, 100% of it goes to the authors as a way to support them, to thank them. And if you are a premium podcast member at drtenpenny.com, you have lifetime access to these fabulous courses for free as part of your membership. So just to go forward with that. So tonight is part three of our four-part series on Bible eschatology, the study of end times, with Dr. Justin Prock. Dr. Justin Prock grew up in the Episcopalian church. However, his family left the church and spent several years church shopping. In 2003, the Lord brought him to U-Turn for Christ Calvary Ministry, where his Bible education started, and he's been an incredible student ever since. He spent over 20 years in management in the United States. He lived in California, and then he moved to South Korea about 14 years ago, where he's currently teaching English, English and culture, including Bible prophecy, current events, economics, history, and political science at a university in South Korea. Ever the student, Dr. Prock holds, and I'm listing all of these different things for you, the listener, to understand the credentials that he brings to the table for our discussion tonight and last 2 weeks and this night and the next night. Dr. Prock holds bachelor's in history from Tennessee Technological University, a master's in biblical studies, a master's of divinity, a doctorate of biblical studies in eschatology from Louisiana Baptist University. He also holds a certificate in kingdom studies from the National Bible College in Durham, England, a certificate in Christian education from the American Institute of Theology, and four certificates from the Bible Mastery Bootcamp. He has written several books. One of them is Why Did Yahweh and His Son Yeshua Say These Things? The second one, and the one that we're spending a lot of time talking about, is Bible Eschatology, the Study of End Times and the Exclusiveness of Israel in the Bible. His next book, The Seed of Nakash, I think I'm not saying that right.
Nakash.
Thank you. Nakash. Yeah. What Every Christian Needs to Know. And he just completed his most recent book, My People Are Destroyed for Lack of Knowledge. And when I say books, I mean books. Look at these. Look at how thick these books are. This one is over 1,100 pages. That is just, to me, the struggling author who struggles every week to write a Substack at about 1,800 words. Writing an 1,100-word book tells you how much he's ever the student. So tonight, in part three of our four-part student series on Bible eschatology, we're going to discuss the major prophecies of the Old Testament in the Greek Old Testament, which was written by 72 Israelites, six from each tribe. How did the language differ from that of authorized King James Version in regard to Daniel 2, 7, and 9, and Ezekiel 38 and 39? And we'll find the differences to be as different as night and day. So let's dig in. Dr. Prock, welcome so much to come back for week three of this special educational series. The first 2 weeks that we were together and we talked about this, you started by saying that some of this material would be controversial, and it was extremely interesting to me. I just love the controversial things.
I do too. That's why I study them. Thank you for having me on again. I tend to lift the rug to see what's under there every once in a while. So tonight we're going to talk about more controversial things. And the pivotal controversial eschatological passage is going to be Daniel 9:24-27, which will change the paradigm of probably just about everybody out there. Wow. Everybody believes that they Antichrist is the one who makes the covenant with the many, but there is specific language in the Septuagint that alludes to someone else. And so Jesus Christ himself, they call it the Messiah. And so he is named right there in black and white. So we'll get to that here in a minute. First, let's cover Daniel chapter 2, because I want you to see a special verse in there. And I'm going to read a few verses from the Septuagint version real quick. Okay, I'm going to start in chapter 2, verse 31. And it says, "Thou, O king, didst behold, and lo, an image. Great was that image, and its aspect lofty as it stood before thee, and its appearance was awful. It was an image of the head, of which was of pure gold. The hands and the breast and the arms were of silver, the belly and thighs of brass, the legs of iron, the feet partly of iron and partly of potter's clay." We've all heard that. "With wonder thou didst view it, till from a mountain there was rent without hands a stone, which smote the image on the feet, which were of iron and potter's clay, and at last broke them to pieces. Then were broken to pieces at once the clay, the iron, the brass, the silver, the gold." And you notice the order going up the chain. "And they became like the dust of the threshing floor in summer, and a great wind swept them away, and there was no place found for them. And the stone which smote the image became a great mountain and filled all the earth. This is the dream, the meaning of it we will now explain to the king. Thou, O king, art the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven hath given a kingdom strong and mighty and glorious." Okay, verse 38. "In every place where the sons of men dwell, into thy hand he hath delivered the beasts of the field and the birds of the air, the fishes of the sea, and appointed thee Lord over all. Thou art the head of gold. And after thee there shall be raised up another kingdom inferior to thee, then a third kingdom, which is the brass, which shall rule over the earth." So we're talking about Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece. Okay, so those are the first three that correspond to the first three metals. Okay, "then a fourth kingdom, which shall be as strong as iron breaketh to pieces and subdueth all things, so shall it break and subdue all. And inasmuch as thou sawest the feet and toes, partly of clay and partly of iron, it shall be a jointed kingdom, though there shall be in it some of its iron root, as thou sawest the iron mixed with the clay. And the toes of the feet were part iron and part clay. Some part of that kingdom will be strong, some part of it will be broken." Okay, there's a difference there in the King James. You know, this is the Septuagint. "Inasmuch as thou sawest the iron mingled with the clay, there will be mixtures of it in the seed of men, and they will not cement one with another, as iron doth not cement with clay." Okay. Now here is the key verse, verse 44. "And in the days of those kings," so we're talking about from Babylon to Rome. Okay. "So in the days of those kings that was previously talked about, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed." That means something on earth was created that is God's kingdom, and it's here, it's present. Okay. "And this kingdom of his shall not be left to another people. It shall break in pieces and blow away all those kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." So remember, according to 1 Peter 4:17, judgment comes to the house of God, correct? And hence the house of God is the house of Jacob, according to Zechariah 13:8, and wherein two-thirds of Israel will be cut off and die, but one-third will go through the refining fire to be purified, okay? And that actually lines up with the, how shall we phrase this, the Deagle Report. From 2015 to 2025, that gave estimates on death rates in 2025 with regard to the Western nations. Two-thirds of, I believe, according to the Deagle Report, two-thirds of America and England pass away, maybe 50% of Europe, one-third of the Asian allies pass away, but the eastern part of the world doesn't. They actually increase. So that's a little sidebar. As thou, and continuing with verse 45, as thou sawest that without hands there was cut from a mountain a stone, which broke in pieces the clay, the iron, the brass, the silver, the gold, the God who is great hath made known to the king, which must come to pass hereafter. The dream indeed is true, and the interpretation thereof is faithful. So I want you to see in verse 44 that in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. Okay? That's the important part. It's here on the earth. Okay? Like we talked about in episode one, we talked about who was the house of Israel, where did they go, who is the house of Judah, where did they go, what happened to them, who are the Jews, and where did they go. So the kingdom is basically wherever there is a king. It requires land. It requires, obviously, the monarchy is there. It requires people, and it requires law, correct? So the Romans had the legal system upon which the British have based their legal system on, right? And so as we go through this, I'll try connecting the dots so that it's made more clear. If you have questions, ask as we go along, okay? You doing all right?
Yes, so, absolutely.
Okay. Uh-huh. Okay. Let's see. Daniel 7. Daniel 7, 2 through 5. And I, Daniel, beheld, and lo, the four winds of heaven blew violently on the great sea. The four great beasts came up out of the sea, different one from the other. The first one was like a lioness. Now, in the King James, it's a lion. So why is it feminine in the Septuagint? And had wings like those of an eagle. I beheld till her wings were plucked off, and she was raised from the earth and stood on the feet of a man, and a man's heart was given her. And behold, the second beast was like a bear, and it stood half erect, and there were three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said to it thus, arise, devour much flesh. After this, I looked, and lo, another beast like a leopard, and it had four wings of a bird on it. And this beast had four heads, and to it dominion was given. And this I beheld, and lo, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong, and its teeth of iron, devouring and crushing to pieces, and the residue is trampled with its feet. Now this was far different from all the beasts which were before it, and it had 10 horns. So the beasts line up with the metal image. That's the traditional interpretation of it, okay? And then he goes on in verse 9, I attended to its horns, and behold, another little horn sprouted up in the midst of them, and three of the horns which were before it were rooted out from before it. And behold, in this horn there were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Verse 17, these beasts which are four denote that four kingdoms shall be raised up on the earth. And the earth being defined as that geographical area, okay? It's not talking about the whole earth. For example, when Caesar taxed the world, he didn't tax the Eskimos and the Chinese and the, right? So it's, earth has to be a very finite place, okay? And without getting into too much controversy, we'll hold that one thought for just a moment. These shall be removed, and the holy ones of the Most High shall take the kingdom and hold it to an age of the ages. Then I, Daniel, inquired particularly concerning the fourth beast, because it was different from every beast, exceedingly dreadful. Its teeth were of iron, and its claws of brass. It's Greco-Roman, okay? It devoured and broke in pieces, and the residue it trampled with its feet. And concerning the 10 horns which were on its head, and that other horn which sprouted up and shook off the three first, and which had eyes and a mouth speaking great things, and the appearance of which was greater than the rest. And I beheld, and that horn made war on the holy ones and prevailed against them, until the Ancient of Days came and gave judgment for the holy ones of the Most High, and the time came, and the holy ones possessed the kingdom. And he said, with regard to the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on the earth which shall surpass all the kingdoms and devour all the earth and trample down and cut to pieces. And its 10 horns denote that 10 kingdoms shall be raised up, and after them another shall be raised up, which shall exceed in evils all those before and shall humble 3 kings. Here is the interpretation now. And shall speak words against the Most High and wear out the holy ones of the Most High and think of changing times and law, God's times and law. And this beast shall be put in its power for a time and times and half a time, 1,260 years, okay? A day for a year in prophecy like we discussed in episode 2, okay? When the court hath sat, they will change this government to abolish and destroy it utterly. For the kingdom and the dominion and the majesty of the kings who are under the whole heaven is given to the holy ones of the Most High, and his kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all the governments shall serve and obey him. To this is the end of this word. Okay. Now, the interpretation. With regard to the little horn, verse 4, we talked about Babylon, right? Verse 5, we talked about Medo-Persia. The 3 ribs that Medo-Persia had in its mouth were Babylon, Egypt, and Lydia. And then in verse 6, we talked about Greece with the leopard with the 4 wings representing the 4 generals that took over after Alexander died. The 4 heads... his 4 generals, Cassander, he was in charge of Greece after Alexander died. Lysimachus took over Asia Minor. Seleucus, who is very famous, took over Syria and Babylon. And Ptolemy took over Egypt. And ultimately, is Seleucus in the north versus Ptolemy in the south for basically all the way through, even into the intertestamental period between the 2 testaments. Verse 7 is Rome pagan. Verse 8 is the Gothic nation, the West. And so the 10 horns. Sir Isaac Newton, not only was he a physicist and a great scientist, he also studied Bible prophecy. And this is where this comes from. He said that the 10 horns are, number one, the Vandals, the Suevi, the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, the Lombards, the Heruli, the Franks, the Alemanni, the Huns, and the Burgundians. Okay, 10 kingdoms. All right. Verse 8, the little horn, the papacy. Okay. So Rome transferred from pagan Rome, and it went through 7 different stages, and then the papacy ended up taking it over and became Rome, okay? And the Great Tribulation, I will show, is during a certain time period, and we'll get to that in just a second. So the 3 empires or horns that the papacy plucked up, the Lombards, the Vandals, and the Ostrogoths, okay? So those 3 were gone. So the papacy took over. Now, I have a chart, and it shows that the head of gold, I don't know if you can see this properly. Well, maybe not. Let me describe it a little bit. The head of gold, obviously, is the Babylonian lion. The breast, arms, and silver correspond to Medo-Persia, the bear. The belly, thighs, and brass correspond to the Greek leopard. The legs of iron represent Imperial Rome. And then there's a transition period from 476 AD, which was the fall of the Roman Empire, to 606 AD, which was the beginning of the papacy. And the papacy lasted 1,260 years. In 1866... it got taken away, and modern Babylon replaced it. and then we have Jesus Christ coming. And that is one set of numbers. And during that age, we have the church age underneath from 470 going back to 33 AD up to the present. So God's stone kingdom has been the old covenant and then the new covenant people. All right. So everybody is corresponding in. And basically the beast nations are the ones that have had control over Jerusalem. Okay. So that's how Bible prophecy is being interpreted. Who controlled Jerusalem over this period of time? Does that make sense? Okay. All right. Any questions on Daniel 2 or 7 before we proceed?
The only thing I have a question about, and maybe you're going to come into this, maybe there's more of it, is when you said the papacy ended in 18 something.
Yeah, they lost its power. Napoleon ended up, actually it was before that, and the timeline goes from like 533 to 18 something. I can't remember off the top of my head. There's like two different timelines. And so when Napoleon, he captured the papacy and put the Pope in prison and basically had taken it over. And that was the end of the papal power until the early 1900s, when the papacy came back under the Lateran Council, the Lateran Treaty. And so since that time, we have had eight popes. Seven have passed. Eight, the eighth is of the seven. So there's multiple fulfillment in Bible prophecy, okay? So whether we're talking about nations or we're talking about popes, in when we get to Revelation 17 and 18 next time, we'll talk about that Bible prophecy with regard to the seven kings, the eighth king, the eighth is of the seven. Well, it can be shown that there were seven popes, and the eighth pope, Francis, is of the seven. He's a type of pope. Is he the anti-pope, though, or is he a real pope? That's the question. So,
you know, it's interesting that when I was in college, I had a real, real interest in Roman history. In fact, I had enough, I took enough classes when I was in college that I technically could have had a minor just in Roman history, because I just found that period and everything so much about it just so interesting. And I took a course after I graduated called Rome, the Eternal City, and it was talking about the layout of Washington, D.C. in terms of what the Roman, you know, structure was. And, you know, I wrote a paper during that time on because what we were studying was the fall of the Roman Empire and how it really was, it took 50 to 100 years, something like that. People think when, you know, it fell, it was like today it was here and tomorrow it was gone. No, it was like this slow deterioration. And I wrote a paper because we had to write a paper, and then there was a final exam, so we didn't really have a midterm. And the paper I wrote, I think I still have it. And this was like in the early 90s, because the guy who was the professor said, oh my gosh, this was just unbelievable. And what I did was I took our textbook that was talking about the decline of the Roman Empire, and I compared it to modern day headlines from the newspaper.
Okay.
And that was what my paper was about. You know, it was talking about in the book, it was talking about you know, the street gangs and how it wasn't safe to go out at night. It was talking about, you know, the circus and all the entertainment things that they would do to sort of distract you from the really horrible things that were happening inside of the government. And I wrote, it was a 20-page paper, and I took daily headlines out of the newspaper, and then I compared it to the stuff that was in the textbook that they were using. And that was in the early 90s. And so how much further along we are of that disintegration and crumbling of you know what's happening the decline and fall of the American empire, I guess you could say, and the British empire that's just disintegrating. And it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, I suppose it could happen overnight if there was suddenly a nuclear bomb or something. But this slow disintegration and falling apart, you know, and I know that so much of those of Daniel's prophecies are really like what you were saying. It's about the world as they knew it at the time. It was about the Middle East and Persia and Babylon and what was happening in Mesopotamia. But it also has, obviously, it has ramifications of what's happening now that we've got the whole world. You know, we've got the all these different things.
Exactly. So it's spread out over.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody is spread out. And, you know, the biggest problem with Rome was the disintegration of the family, disintegration of education, the overspreading of spending on military and overreach, their economic problems. You can line that all up with the United States today.
Yep. And then the Visigoths came in from the north, and, you know, they were the ones who really, you know, broke through the Romans' military might, because, as you said, they were spread too thin. You know, we're getting to the place, and, you know, now when we look at America and the southern borders being opened and all the being overrunning was the same thing that was happening in the Roman Empire with the Visigoths coming in from the north. And the German, you know, Gothic sort of tribes that came in and just infiltrated everything, and they, you know, desecrated the temples and you know, did all these different things. It's just, you know, if we don't know, it's so important. And I'm just such a lover of history. Like I said, you know, I took a lot of world history courses. All of my liberal arts courses I had to take as a pre-med major in college, all of them were in history, you know, because if we don't know history, if we don't know where we came from, how do we know where we are?
Exactly. And the problem is, were we taught the correct history?
Yes.
You know, for the most part, both of us were, you know, because we probably both went to conservative colleges to a certain extent, I would imagine. I did anyway. You know, Tennessee Tech was somewhat, that was my cat, by the way. Wow. I knew he was going to do that. Anyway, but yeah, I mean, it's kind of like when I came to Korea, I had to reteach myself all those things and deprogram from all the different things that I had learned. And I basically just set out on a course to learn history, economics, politics, who was behind the scenes. It's like the Wizard of Oz. You know, you pull the curtain back and it's like, bingo, you know.
Which is part of what our discussions are here about deprogramming from what we've been taught going to church and what the pastors have been taught. You know, it's not just them. It's who taught them.
We're the robots.
Problem. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Unfortunately. So shall I continue? Here's
yes,
the
please.
Biggest one. Daniel 9:24 through 20:27. This is the big Bible prophecy one that has to do with everyone in dispensationalism says that this is the Antichrist making a covenant with Israel. Okay. Now listen to the Septuagint version. In verse 24, there are seven things that Jesus Christ did when he came the first time. In the King James, there's only six, and I'll point out the difference. 70 weeks are set apart for thy people and for the holy city. That means talking about Daniel, which is the house of Judah, and the holy city being Jerusalem. Okay. Number one, for finishing sin offerings. So no more temple. And for sealing up sin offerings, putting an end to it, blotting out iniquities. Number four, which is not in the King James, making atonement for iniquities. Who does that? That's Jesus Christ. He's the only one that can make atonement for the iniquities of Israel, right? Blood has to cover, you know, he was our propitiation. And he took our place. Instead of us dying, he died for everyone. Okay. Number five, for bringing in an everlasting righteousness, which he did. Number six, for sealing vision and prophet. So John the Baptist was the last of the Old Testament prophets, and sealing the vision, he had said it, no more. Okay. I'm not talking about the book of Revelation where Jesus, goes to John and says, here's the prophecy. But I'm talking about the vision and the prophet from the Old Testament and for anointing the Holy of Holies. And it stated in Barb Kornucki's book, which I'm going to get to here in a minute, or I guess in the next episode, I'm going to talk about that under Matthew 24 when he talks about the temple. He talks about Jesus Christ's blood anointed the Holy of Holies, which was underneath it, okay, in a cave. So, verse 25, therefore thou art to know and understand that from the going forth of a word for a returning an answer and for building Jerusalem until an anointed ruler are 7 weeks and 62 weeks, they shall indeed return, and a street shall be built and a wall, and these times shall be emptied out. Okay? So, and I'll explain it here in just a minute. Verse 26. And after the 62 weeks, the Messiah shall be cut off, though there is no crime in him. And he, meaning the Messiah, with the ruler who is coming, Titus Vespasian, will destroy the city and the sanctuary. They shall be destroyed with a deluge, and even to the end of the war, determined on in course with desolations. Now, 1 week shall confirm a covenant with many, and in the half of that week, my sacrifice, my being capitalized, meaning God, my sacrifice and libation shall be taken away. In the middle of the week when Christ crucified, no more sacrifices were needed at all. Okay? And upon the temple shall be an abomination of the desolations, that at the end of a time an end shall be put to that desolation. And in, I think it was in episode one, I referred to that as being Israel. The state of Israel, because they should not exist at all. And so when you take a look at that prophecy, that basically, verse 26 kills dispensationalism. It kills the Antichrist theory of doing the covenant with the many. Jesus Christ came, and it says the Messiah shall be cut off, though there is no crime in him. He, with the ruler who is coming, will destroy the city and the sanctuary. That happened in 70 AD. They shall be destroyed with a deluge, and even to the end of the war, determined on in course with desolations. And then 1 week shall confirm a covenant, the new covenant, with many, meaning Israel. And in the half of that week, my sacrifice and libation shall be taken away. So it's very simple. So that's why I always use the Septuagint ever since Doug Woodward. I read his book, and it was like, wow, I didn't know that, you know. So Kevin Shortkin was another author. He wrote a book called The Israel Deception. He says logic requires that 70 weeks refers to one consecutive block of time, in other words, to 70 straight sequential weeks. There's no gap between 69 and 70. It goes all the way through, unlike what futurists and dispensationalists teach. Okay. And the truth is, there is no example in the Bible of a stated time period starting, stopping, and then starting again. All biblical references to time are consecutive. For example, Genesis 7, chapter 7, verse 4, 40 days and 40 nights, no break. 400 years in Egypt in Genesis 15, 13, no break. 70 years of captivity for Babylon, no break. Right? So all of the Bible prophecy is consecutive. Okay. Now, the 70 weeks of Daniel, and here's where I will explain it. In 457 BC, according to Artaxerxes' decree, you add 49 years of troubled building under Nehemiah, which brings us to 408 BC. Okay. So seven sevens, we're talking about week of weeks. Okay. And so seven times seven is 49 years, right? Basically a day for a year. Now, 408 BC plus 434 years, which is the 62 weeks until the anointed ruler comes to 27 AD, the beginning of Jesus Christ's ministry. And that corresponds with what we discussed. Jesus Christ was born in 6 BC at least, because Herod the Great died in 4 BC, and Jesus would have been 2, and Herod would have gone after the 2-year-olds. So if you go from 6 and then up to 27, he was at least 30, right? So 33. So 27 AD plus 3.5 years of his ministry comes to spring of 31 AD when Jesus was crucified. 31 AD plus the other half of the week, the 3.5 years, comes to 34 AD, the time of the last preaching to the Jews. And then 70 AD is the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple by the Romans because they didn't listen. 78:3 was the destruction of Masada, the final destruction. Over 1 million Jews were killed during Titus Vespasian's taking and burning of Jerusalem and sacking the temple and everything. And in 135 AD was the destruction of the Bar Kokhba revolt by the Romans and the final permanent destruction of Israel as we knew it. Yeah. It was never to be there, because they had already moved in the Isles, as we discussed in episode 1. Okay. They would have a new place, a new language, a new king. They would have everything they needed that God promised, okay, after the 2,520 years of judgment, okay? So some experts argue that the date is 30 AD, hence the 40 years of testing for the nation of Judah before its destruction in 70 AD. So some experts say it's 30, 31, 32, 33. Either way, they're in their 30s, somewhere in there is when all of this happened, okay? Now, according to the, let's see, I want to skip this. Okay, any questions over Daniel chapter 9? That was controversial. That was the one that explains it, because in the King James, may I read the King James real quick?
Sure.
So verse 26, which is the one that's controversial in the Masoretic text, the one that was corrupted by Rabbi Akiba in 130 AD, it says, "And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself, and the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even until the consumption, and that determined shall be poured out upon the desolate." Does that make sense?
Kind of.
To be honest, that Bible prophecy is totally messed up. So when you reread it again in the Septuagint version, that verse 26, where is it? And it says, "After 62 weeks, the Messiah shall be cut off, though there is no crime in him, and he with the ruler who is coming." So he, the Messiah, will be coming with the ruler who is coming, which is Titus Vespasian, will destroy the city and the sanctuary. They shall be destroyed with a deluge, meaning war, and even to the end of the war, determine on in course with desolations. And then it says, "Now 1 week shall confirm a covenant with many, and in the half of that week, my," meaning the Lord God, "my sacrifice and libation shall be taken away." And upon the temple shall be an abomination of the desolations, and at the end of time, an end shall be put to that desolation. That makes more sense. You see what I mean?
So kind of wrap around this a little bit of what is our take-home message from this, and why is it important?
Okay, the take-home message is that for Bible prophecy and for reading the Bible in general, everyone should get a copy of the Septuagint version and read it for themselves and study it. And with regard to that Bible prophecy, it explains exactly who the Antichrist is and who Jesus Christ is. Excuse me a moment. My cat. He wasn't in here last night, but he was sleeping up above. Anyway, so the importance of the passage in the Septuagint shows exactly that it was the Messiah that comes in with Titus Vespasian and destroys the temple and the sacrifice. No more sacrificing. And even God himself says in the next verse that I took away the oblation in halfway through the week. So the sacrifice of Jesus Christ was a once and for all sacrifice for the Israelites, for the atoning of their sins because of the law. Under the law, the death penalty reigned over them forever until Jesus Christ came and made propitiation for their sins. He stood in the gap. So that's the important part that, we
And
need to
it's
take
really
away.
important to think about because, the Jewish people are still waiting for the Messiah. You know,
Yes,
the, you
then
know,
David.
in a lot of the, I mean, the rabbinical ways of thinking of things, it's like
Yes.
Jesus was a good teacher. He was, did a lot of wonderful things. He explained a lot of wonderful things, but they were expecting a warrior king.
Exactly.
And because that warrior king didn't come through the humbleness of Jesus and through his sacrifice through love, they're still waiting for the return of the Messiah, right? Am I got that right?
Exactly. Yes,
No.
and if you read in the Talmud, it says in there that they believe that the Jewish people themselves are the Messiah as a whole.
Wow.
Yes.
So what wh
That's
why
kind
did
of
what
scary.
Why did it happen after World War II that we created this country in this little space called Israel? What was that? What
The
was.
way it happened, President Truman took a bribe from the Jews. He was behind the polls. He took a cash bag of like $2 or $3 million cash. He ended up winning the election. And on May 1st of 1948, Israel became a nation. And the signature, it was supposed to be the nation of the Jews. Truman crossed that out and he said the nation of Israel. So Bible prophecy experts all went nutty, going, oh my God, Israel's been, the fig tree has blossomed and here we go. And here is true Israel. Well, no, it was supposed to be the nation of the Jews, but Truman changed that. Well, Truman was surrounded by Jewish Zionists who influenced him to sign the document to make Israel a nation. Russia, who was basically surrounded by Zionists, was the number two signatory, and they created Israel. And
And
so,
define for people, just so they know, the difference between the Jewish people and Zionists.
Jewish people, like we discussed in episode one and part two, also a little bit, the Jewish people have basically gone through and have been kicked out of every nation throughout history. They were the Edomite Jews that were in Idumea that were forced converted by John Hyrcanus in 135 BC. And then they merged with Judah and became Judea. Then when they were forced out of Rome, they traveled around. And then you have the Khazarian Empire, which is the Eastern European Jews who converted to Judaism. And so you have this group of people that are mixed, that are basically the people that Jesus Christ refers to in Revelation 2:9 and 3:9 as those who say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. Those people groups, out of that people group, the cream of the crop, decided that they needed to create a homeland in Palestine. And that ended up becoming Zionism. And Theodor Herzl was the father of modern Zionism to a certain extent. And it was he who in 1897 had the first Congress. And that's where they decided to set up shop in Palestine and get rid of the Palestinians. And so you see in 1917, 20 years later, we had World War One. What was the purpose of that? You had the Balfour Agreement. You had the General Allenby, who is British, who took Jerusalem for Lord Rothschild, right? So all of that was set up for the Zionists. World War One was a Zionist war for their accomplishments. And then World War Two was to set up the nation state of Israel, because the whole world would feel sad because of the so-called Holocaust. And so that is why. And if you notice who fought World War One and World War Two, they were Christian nations versus Christian nations, whites versus whites. And so Christianity died after a slow death after that, because many Christians died during those wars. So that's why you see the morality change in the 1960s with the there's a divide right there in with regard to 1950 and 1960 is like the period of time where trends changed. And then 1960, everything was morally corroded, and we started following basically the Babylonian Talmud in all its evil. So, yes, that's controversial, but it's true. I mean, look it up. Peter Schaefer, Dr. Peter Schaefer, wrote a book on Jesus in the Talmud, and in it, he talks about how the rabbis wrote about Jesus Christ being a bastard, burning in excrement in hell.
Oh, wow.
Mary was a whore who had sex with a Roman soldier. Okay. So, I mean, the whole thing is just, it's horrible. And they even have a law where they hate Christians. They'll put up with us. Pardon me?
Who is this now that has this law? Who is it?
We're talking about the Jews.
Judaism, wow.
In the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud.
Wow.
The oral law, the oral traditions that Jesus Christ came against.
Wow.
That's why they hated him. And remember, I told you in the Bible, 21 times it says they wanted to kill him. And then with the Romans, zero.
Wow.
The Romans didn't want to kill him at all. Had no reason to. So, you know, that's why when you take a look at the Gospel of John, it is them who take Jesus Christ and crucify him. So Pontius Pilate washed his hands. And then what did the Edomite Jews say that were in the crowd? His blood be on us and on our children. That was a perpetual curse throughout all time. And they have been cursed ever since then.
Wow.
Yes.
It's fascinating.
Yes. It's brutal, but it's the truth. And that's why the Jews today want to get rid of the Gospels, and especially the Gospel of John, because it's so-called anti-Semitic, right? Because it puts them in a bad light. Well, truth is truth. Well, here's something else for you. All the way up through Vatican II, most of the popes, the Catholic popes, either kicked out the Jews or they destroyed the Talmud and set it on fire. Now, with Vatican II, Rothschild made a loan to the papacy that they needed money badly. And all of a sudden, under Vatican II, the Jews didn't crucify Jesus Christ.
Wow. Wow.
Yes. Yes. Rothschild was responsible for that. He's responsible for the building of the State of Israel. I mean, the architecture in Israel, it's all Masonic. Everything is totally not, they are not the people of the book. So,
Wow.
That was a sidetrack. We went
but
off
that
on
was
it.
Really important. I mean, that's really important things to understand. Again, kind of what I alluded to. I mean, if you don't really know the history, if you don't know historical documentations and being able to understand from whence we come, then you just blindly accept what you've been told and expect that the people who are telling you know what they're talking about when they just maybe
same way.
When they just need to be, when they just may be, you know, parrots of what they were taught, you know. So you've got multi-generational parroting that didn't have anything to do with what the reality was.
Exactly. And I grew up in the 60s, late 60s and 70s. I remember throughout the 70s, the Holocaust series was on TV every year. So it got, you know, into the brain. You know, they made lampshades out of the skin. They did this. They did that. They made soap out of people. None of it's true. Okay. It's just like with the Palestinians, the Hamas did not go out and cut off the heads of 40 babies. Didn't happen. Okay. So it's all propaganda, as we discussed about before in the previous lectures.
Well, and before any of the audience that's listening to this gets all hysterical and gets their hair on fire and starts sending me email after email and written letters even claiming that I'm like an anti-Semitic, you know, sort of thing. You know, I'm just looking at this entire conversation as this is just a historical fact. And so much of what we've been told is a rewrite of history, because what does the word even history stand for? His story. The person who wins writes the story and they tell it from their perspective. And so this is a different perspective. We're not hating Israel. We're not, you know, picking sides and saying all these things. This is just a historical revelation of things that, you may not have heard this from before. And you said from the beginning, people may find it controversial because of what they've been taught and they believe is true and isn't necessarily truth. It's sort of like, and I use the analogy in those people that have followed me for a long time, you know, it's like all your pediatrician will tell you that vaccines are safe and effective.
Huh.
And all of you who have actually done the homework or actually taken my courses or taken, followed me for a long time, understand what safe really means. It's never been tested. And what effective really means in terms of how it's used. It's a definition. Effective, we think that effective means it keeps us from getting sick. And from a scientific perspective, all it means is that if I inject you with foreign matter and you develop an antibody, then it was effective. It did what it was supposed to do. Does that antibody keep you from getting sick? Probably not. It's just a marker of a contamination. And so how many of you have studied like the vaccine stuff that we've done and understand what even just this simple part of safe and effective is all about, but people expect their pediatricians to have done all of this homework and they haven't. So put this information that we're putting together tonight and putting forward to you tonight in context of what you've been taught and what the historical documents actually say.
Exactly. And that's all we're doing here. We're showing exactly what the Septuagint Bible, which is the original Bible that corresponds to every New Testament, especially the King James, the language matches up. And the Masoretic text was corrupted. So the problem becomes, number one, we were lied to. Number two, all the Bible prophecies with regard to Messiah have been messed up. And then obviously you just saw in Daniel chapter 9, that was a huge Bible prophecy that everybody spun off on and written thousands of books on the Antichrist and who it is and who makes the covenant. Whereas with the Septuagint, it clearly says it was the Messiah. God himself made the covenant. He stopped it and then created a new one. So,
wow.
yeah.
Very important. Very important. And, you know, we've only got a couple of minutes left in this episode. And we talked about this a little bit before we went live about detoxing from, you know, from our roots. And you said you were going to say a couple of words about how we start to look at things differently and detox from what we believe is the truth.
Well, God basically had to move me out of America. I was a sports fan. I mean, you know, I drank beer. I was just a regular guy. I didn't study anything. And even though I had had Calvary Chapel in my background, I was a Sunday churchgoer only. And it wasn't until, like, basically I got over here to Korea. Yes, I knew the scriptures, but coming over here, I was forced to study everything because I had to teach history and economics and political science at a private Christian school. So I started re-educating myself. And so I have a whole library is basically my journey of educating me. You know, what is dispensationalism? What is Christianity? What does Christianity really teach? Is it pagan? Yes. Constantine basically took a temple and built it. He put a phallic symbol on top, the steeple, and then he put the sign of the sun god on top, the cross. Jesus Christ was crucified on a basically a stake, stakos in the Greek. Okay. So,
it wasn't a cross.
It was a stake. It was a stake like this. So that's what the Greek word means.
So the hands that were nailed, they were nailed together on a stake as opposed to nailed into a cross?
On a cross. Yes.
Holy
that's
cow.
What the well that's what
talk
the Greek
about
word
changing
means.
Paradigms in your brain, you know.
Well, and that's something I found that was like I kept researching it, and I was like, you know, because all throughout history, that pagan symbol of the cross, whether it's like this and then a circle around it, always meant the sun god. And so what on earth is that, you know? But when you read the Greek and you look up the word for cross, it's stakos, and it means stake. And so, you know, what do you do with that? You know, it's something that's still controversial. It's something I'm still trying to figure out. Is that absolutely true? You know, I just throw it out there because I know what the Greek word means, and it's different from what the English translation is. Because
that would, you know, make sense. You could still have both of your hands, still have the holes that Thomas put his fingers through and stuff.
Yeah,
but
just
it's
like this.
Here, it's
yeah,
up here,
up above. That's
as
why
opposed to out here.
Crucifixion was so horrible, because you're drowning in your own liquid, and it's a slow, horrible death, right? So basically, everything is being drained from you. Excuse
it's
me.
Horribly painful.
Yes.
I mean,
I
think
mean,
about it, if anybody that just, you know, go and put your hands on a bar and how long you can, you know, you don't, and now imagine hanging from that, all the sinew and how everything.
Yes.
And then you've got the nails through your feet. So if you try to push yourself up to give yourself some relief, you've got this agonizing pain of the stake through your feet.
Exactly.
Oh my
That was the
goodness.
whole point. And it's one of the worst torturous deaths that ever was created. I
because
mean,
it's slow
of,
because it's
yeah,
slow too.
exactly.
It's slow agony. It's not unlike when they would four poster your arms and legs to four different horses and make them run.
Right.
That's
Drawn
like,
and quartered.
I mean, that's terribly painful, but instantaneous death.
Right.
I mean, as soon as you're torn apart, you're dead. unlike and, this that would take hours of
right.
agony.
And think about this. Jesus himself gave up the ghost. He said, it is finished. And then it also says in the Bible, it said, I think Jacob gave up the ghost. Are people able to do that? That is something that's rather provocative. It's kind of like when you're ready to die, can you release your spirit?
I believe people can.
Okay.
Because I actually have an experience with that.
Oh.
When I was still an ER doc, full-time ER doc, the rooms, it was in a square. And so there were rooms that went around. And the first room across from the nurse's station had one bed in it, and it was our cardiac room. The next three rooms had two beds in it, and they could be anything that people were there for. And I'll never forget this, Justin. It was just really dramatic. An old man, probably in his 80s, had been brought in from a nursing home. And he was not doing well. And he just had a niece that was sort of his power of attorney. And he was in that bed. And he'd been pretty unresponsive for most of the time that he'd been there, because we were trying to get a bed upstairs to move him up into the hospital. I believe he had pneumonia was his underlying thing. And he was on a cardiac monitor. And, you know, it just would peek my head in the door occasionally just to check on him. And because he was peaceful, he was restful. We had him in a sit-up position. And one of the times that I looked in there, he'd probably been in there an hour or two, maybe a little bit longer. And I just peeked in the door and he opened his eyes, which was the first time he'd done that since he'd been in that bed. He opened his eyes and looked at me and went, and I literally saw a figment of that went, and his EKG and his monitor went flatline when he did that.
Wow.
It was, I mean, that was 30 years ago, maybe longer. I'll never forget it because I was like, did anybody see that but me? Did you just see what just happened here? And
wow.
and he just opened his eyes and he went, and you could see kind of a thing, some, and his cardiac monitor immediately went flatline. So that's my N of one, my experience of one, dramatic though it was.
Right.
You know, it was pretty darn dramatic.
Yeah.
And so
so it's possible.
So for what it's worth, that's, like you said, that's my experience, my N of one. But it was something I'll never forget. And it was, that was probably 40 years ago. And I remember it as clearly in my mind as if it was 4 minutes ago.
Sure.
It
that's
was pretty
an
dramatic.
Indelible print on your brain.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's like, I'll never forget that.
I'll never forget that. You know, there's, you know, as an ER doc, there's lots of things that you get imprinted, you know, that you'll never forget. But
yes,
anyways, as we're winding up here, just in the last minute or two, how would you like to, what would be the take home message that you would like to leave people with on tonight's session before we come back next week for our final session?
Sure. I think everyone should go to archive.org, look up the name Charles Thompson, and in it you will find, when it comes up, and you may even type in Septuagint next to his name, you can get a free PDF of the Septuagint Bible and also his New Testament. And they correspond, very truthful, very factual, much different from the Masoretic text. Stay away from any Bible that has a Masoretic text.
Which
so,
would be like the Scofield series.
All the Protestant Bibles are based on the Masoretic text. The received text, as the Baptists used to say. So the King James only, you know. So,
oh, well, here's a whole new thing. And this is why we do these Thursday night series, people, why we did them last year with Doug Woodward, which you've alluded to a couple of times, and with L.A. Marzulli, Doug Van Dorn, when we talked about the Giants. And, you know, it was, we had an entire, you know, all of 2023. And the reason that we bring these to you in these four part series is to introduce you to information that you may not have heard before, And you may be sitting there listening to this going, I don't believe it. Well, go research it for yourself and then decide. Because when you actually, if you go out to Dr. Justin Prock's website, it's got over 4,000 PDF articles still under a little bit under construction of putting things up there. And he offers that to you for free to go out and just start learning and not be just so indoctrinated. So I want to thank everybody so much for joining us here tonight. This has just been incredible as far as I'm concerned. It's both grateful and an honor for all of you who've joined us here with Happy Hour for Dr. T and are listening to this in the future. If you've missed it for tonight, it'll be free and listed on drtempany.com through the end of next month. Then it gets moved into the archives. We will sell it. And as we sell it, and the money will go directly to Dr. Justin here for all of his incredible in-depth studying and work. So if you go out and become, you're not yet a premium podcast member, hover over the podcast area on the drtempany.com site. There's four different membership levels, and we believe we've created something for everyone's time and budget. So tell them again where they can get your books, Dr.
Okay.
Justin, where that could
be. Thank you. You can go to traffordpublishing.com, and that's where three of my books were published. Or you can go to my website, and there are five books there in PDF form. And you can download those for free and read them. Basically, the reason I wrote the books was basically to try to educate the public and wake them up. It's a giant red pill. It's an ugly red pill.
You're like me, you like to highlight and underline and dog ear and do this. If you want a hardback copy, you can get it from the Trafford Publishing, or you can get it off of Amazon.
Exactly.
Amazon has the hardback publishing there. But if you're okay and you can, you know, do all those different things from a PDF file, because I also have accounts on Audible because sometimes I like to listen to things and I have things, you know, that I can read online. But if you want a hardback copy that you can have forever, and I always say to people, if you know, books that are really important to you, you should have in hardback, because when they, you know, go poof to the internet and it's all gone. It's all exactly. There's a demonstration of that. So before we do our final say goodnight for tonight, would you lead us in prayer in closing for our session tonight?
Sure, you bet. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for bringing us together again safely. And we just thank you for the audience that you provide, Dr. Tenpenny and me. We just ask, Father God, that you bless them and be with them. And we ask that you open up everyone's eyes to see and ears to hear and hearts to receive your word, Father God. I pray that everyone goes out and tries to find the truth instead of wasting their time doing other things. I pray, Father God, that in these end times that you bring all of us together with your truth and your truth only. We thank you and we praise you and we just thank you for all the blessings you've provided. We ask all this in Jesus Christ's name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you so much. And yes, that's really true. I mean, spend some time learning and learning something new. You know, I've done that on a couple of my own happy hours and saying, you know, spend time educating yourself and digging into things instead of just watching cat videos on TikTok. and sometimes, sometimes that's a little bit entertaining. And sometimes we need a little levity in our life, you know, something that we can laugh at. Like some of those videos are certainly funny and they're short, they're 2 minutes long. I mean, that's, you know, a little bit of entertainment value. That's fine. But don't live out there on YouTube and watching, you know, nonsensical things or on TikTok and stuff like that.
Don't waste your life.
Don't waste your life. That's exactly true. I just bought a book title that has that in the title. It's called Don't Waste Your Life. It's really actually really quite good. And it's the whole point of the book is talking about in all things that you do it for the Lord is really what is what the book is about. So with that, everybody, thank you so much for hanging in here with us tonight. We have one more episode of this coming up next week that we will conclude with this. And so I close tonight with one of my favorite verses from the Bible that I always like to close my podcast with, which is Romans 12:12. Rejoice in hope, be patient in trouble, and be persistent in prayer. So until the next time, remember to lean into God, trust him for everything. Be sure to mark your calendars for next Thursday night for part 4 of Bible Eschatology with Dr. Justin Prock. And hang around here just for a couple of minutes to hear a word from our sponsors. And with that, I want to say good night and God bless.
In a time when truth is censored, one name stands out. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, the relentless seeker of knowledge and defender of freedom. Explore groundbreaking findings at drtenpenny.com. Ignite your mind with riveting podcasts, explosive articles, research-driven substacks, webinars, ebooks, and more. In an era plagued by environmental toxins and vaccine-related exposures, Dr. Tenpenny has expertly crafted a selection of safe detox protocols that facilitate profound healing at a cellular level. It's time to cleanse, rejuvenate, and restore your body's vitality. With heart damage on the rise, Dr. Tenpenny introduces nationwide ECP therapy to repair hearts and achieve optimal health. Seize the opportunity and embrace the wealth of resources, information, and health recommendations awaiting you at drtenpenny.com and become a Tenpenny podcast member to join our mission in the quest for uncensored truth, the health of our nation, and medical freedom.